And you can get a lot of caca coming out of AI. But the latest wave is a scary one. It's called agentic. And what it means is the software acts as your agent.
Yeah.
Okay. And it can negotiate contracts and agree to contracts on your behalf. And so some of that went wrong and the company shut it off. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, in one instance at least, the software turned itself back on and went back to work.
Really?
It's like you fired an employee and they came to the office the next day.
He's back.
Wait a minute, didn't we fire you?
Welcome to North Point of View. Great to be with Walter. How are you, man?
Oh, I'm great, Mark. Welcome, everybody, to a very carefully scripted North Point of View video.
Absolutely. We're going to stay on script. Actually, we're going to change the name.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Remember, Jenna just came in and said it might be money?
Yes.
And it might be.
It might. Exactly.
It might not.
It could happen.
We bumped into it on the last podcast, AI.
Right.
Let's jump in.
Okay.
I was just sharing with you during the break, having dinner with our two youngest children a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Ava's 22. Their friends were 23, 24 years old, adamantly opposed to AI. You know, the mm-hmm. Gen Zers just... You know, the environment, it's crushing the environment, you know, water usage, power usage, lack of, you know, critical thinking involved, the replacement of, I mean, attendance in school, you just brought that up, you know, the students in their classes are playing video games and online shopping while the professor's pouring his heart out,
mm-hmm.
and they've got their, you know, AI recording, they get a 3-minute summary on an hour and 15 minute lecture. And that's the tip of the iceberg, right?
It is. They're not really getting educated. Although I got to tell you, in some universities, you have graduate students teaching, and I'm not so sure how much.
Sure, doesn't matter.
I was one of those guys once. So, yeah. But no, that you're absolutely right. I work with a few other economists, Derek Cutler at EBP, you know, Spencer Cohen. Derek's the chief economist there, and his, you know, very strict rule is you cannot use AI to write a report. You can use it to check something, but you can't generate anything using AI. And I completely agree. You know, when I was at UBS, we had, this is going back 20, 25 years ago, somebody came to us with this software that could surf the internet, little robots running around the internet and pulled information, and it would write a report for you. And so we looked at it, we listened at it, and, you know, look, it's not that expensive to get. So the head of the research department, you know, called me, he was my boss, and a few others, and what do you think? And we all unanimously concluded that it's a cheap service. So if we buy this and use this, so could our clients, then why should they pay us for our research and the effort that we make?
Right.
So we, you know, politely declined. So the beginnings of all of this kind of quote unquote AI, large learning models, it started a long time
sure.
ago. Before I left academia in 91, 92, 93, we had genetic algorithms and other forms of AI. And I was using that to try to simulate an economy. The problem is that those algorithms could not run on 8086 personal computers. That chip was way too weak. All you could do was write a, you know, get the AI to draw a picture of a Christmas tree.
Right.
Okay. It was, you know, you couldn't simulate an economy. I finally did, but it was like a three-sector economy, and it was kind of useless. But this has been evolving over time. I mean, there are other forms of AI nobody talks about, like agent-based modeling. Yeah. So ABM, as they call it, you invent people, and some of them prefer to, you know, live in cities, some in rural areas, you know, some are really good at making, you know, cars, others are really good at, you know, banking and so forth. you give them some other preferences and skill sets, and you turn them loose in an economy, and you watch the economy evolve. People in real estate use this a lot, so they can figure out, you know, the best use of land and how much it could actually generate in lease payments, et cetera. So, but I had a PhD student from Rutgers. I was, you know, on this committee. I was pretty much the chairman of the committee. And we used an agent-based model to simulate the American economy in three dimensions. You know, we land use was part of our model, because see, in economics, there's no space. Supply and demand. They draw a picture with a supply curve, a demand curve. Where is this supply and demand? Okay, so, you know, that piece is always missing
right.
in economists' thinking.
Yeah.
So we did that, and we think we finished it. He finished it. We published it in an academic journal back in 2012. So a lot of this stuff has been evolving since the 80s. This is nothing new. It's just that it's finally getting more and more user-friendly, because that's when things get adopted, is when, you know, like I was on the internet back in 78, and that was, you know, it was unusual. I mean, we were real geeks, you know, what we did, up to 2 a.m. writing programs, you know, to make the computers physically do stuff. So the software didn't, what the programs that we wrote, they didn't write themselves. We had to write them. And now what's happening is the AI is beginning to write those programs, and hence you get the autonomous vehicles, et cetera. So I've had almost 50 years of writing this curve or watching the evolution. And it wasn't until we made computers simple enough for people who don't want to take the time to learn how to write as much code as I did, when we made it so easy.
But you might be in rarefied air.
Yes.
Just to be clear here, yeah. Walter.
Yeah.
Not everybody spends their day the same way that you do.
No, they didn't. But, you know, back in the day, I used to email a friend of mine at the University of Pennsylvania. And what you had to do is you had to put the destination coordinates in your message, and then you had to specify the route. Because the email went from Florida Atlantic University, you know, to University of Northern Florida, University of Georgia. So it went from one university to the other, because they were the nodes in the system. And before you did that,
you're going back to the 70s now, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got a traffic report. Okay. It said which universities are backed up, so you might not want to send it there. And an email could take up to 3 weeks to arrive.
Yeah.
So can you imagine today?
Yeah.
Listen, if an email doesn't arrive in a few minutes, you're like, wait.
Yep. I mean, you're on the phone with somebody going through data. If you don't have an email in 10 seconds.
Exactly. So wait a second, I'll email it to you. And you flip to your other app, boom, boom, boom.
Where's that?
Okay, you got it? Yeah. Can you see what I mean? All right. But it doesn't go through. What the hell's wrong? So... Those were different times.
And so as I look at, just again, macro, you look at the, you know, Fortune 500 companies investing in AI right now, you know, there's a, I'll just go ahead and say it, I guess, a place where these companies are putting profit over people, right? The culture is saying it's just about the bottom line.
Yeah,
we know that people are going to lose their jobs and that they will be replaced with AI software. How do we work ourselves to a good spot from here, Walter? I think we sort of know the downside, right? The dark side. Is there a path up to a mountaintop where we can see the light?
Yeah, there is. But first, I just want to point out that a lot of companies are struggling to implement AI.
Okay.
Because
great point.
They have to have their own internal AI.
Okay.
If you use, you know, ChatGPT, et cetera, the data is collected by the company and they use that to refine their software. And if you have confidential data that can't leave your company's insight,
right.
then you can't use their AI. So a lot of companies that I work with, other consulting firms, unlike the Kempsey's group, who's very liberal about what AI you use, they can't use it. They have to wait for it to get implemented.
I had a conversation with a CPA a couple of weeks ago who said the same thing. Like, you have to be very careful when you start to use AI because you open up
exactly.
your data.
So I'm very careful when I use it to check my work. But I make sure I'm not putting any data into it. I just let it go out on the internet, find stuff, bring it back, and see if it winds up with what I have. So it doesn't see inside my data banks,
right,
or in any of my files. But it's still not there yet. You get a lot of wrong stuff coming out of it. I don't think it's very logical. It's large language learning models. I get that, but where are truth tables, symbolic logic being used so that instead of coming up with an answer based on what happened, you come up with an answer that's based on what happened, but also thinks forward.
Yes.
You know, I mean, are all of the assumptions today in this problem the same as the ones from whatever experience we had in the past? If so, you're not going to be too wrong. If not, oops. And you can get a lot of caca coming out of AI. But the latest wave is a scary one. It's called agentic. And what it means is the software acts as your agent.
Yeah.
Okay. And it can negotiate contracts and agree to contracts on your behalf. And so some of that went wrong and the company shut it off. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, in one instance at least, the software turned itself back on and went back to work.
Really?
It's like you fired an employee and they came to the office the next day.
He's back.
Wait a minute. Didn't we fire you? I think what people call AI today is still awfully primitive. I'm a huge Ray Kurzweil fan. He wrote a book quite some time ago in which he predicted that we wouldn't have AI like we see it in science fiction and, you know, Isaac Asimov and that stuff. You can tell what I read as a kid, right?
Yeah.
So, and he said not until the 2040s. And he's right. So, yeah, we had some AI back in the 90s. Did we think that it was about to start writing contracts and stuff? No, long ways to go. We always knew that. And so right now the press is getting excited about it, partly because it's interesting, fantasy.
It's user friendly.
But it's also scary because people are worried about their jobs, like you said.
Right.
But let me give you some real historical perspective on these things. You go back to the 1800s and we invented better machinery to make textiles. When they deployed that in the UK, John Ludd led a group of people to go in and bust the looms and all kinds of things. I think it was looms, that's where the Luddites, the term Luddite comes from, stop the technology from being used.
Yeah.
So in the US, we had similar things. And the work week eventually dropped from 6 days, 12 hours, 6 days to 5 days, 12 hours, 5 days, 8 hours. And today the average work week is in the low 30s.
Right.
I mean, we are slowly, kind of working fewer and fewer hours. The water cooler is getting a workout, that's for sure.
And so is the golf course, right?
Yeah, exactly. Fair point. I mean, why even go into the office?
Yeah. Don't need to.
So, but yet our GDP is a massive multiple of what it was when we started mechanizing. And mechanization was the first form of automation. And so sometimes I think people get a little too caught up in science fiction. And no disrespect to anybody who's a data scientist or is working on this. We need these things to evolve. Eventually, we'll have a much shorter work week and maybe you don't have to work,
Hang on to the good and leave the bad, right?
Exactly, because we're going to get more output, right? And, I know a lot of it goes to the stinking rich people. That's fine. But it does eventually create new jobs and it does allow people more time to go spend money, which creates jobs and opportunities in other places. So you're going to see
like that.
See a sectoral shift,
and
you'll get a lot more GDP or income per hour than you did before. The transition, though, was not fun. I mean, we're not going to enjoy that. Watching 20,000 software engineers get the sack at Microsoft earlier this year, that's painful to watch.
Yeah. Really love your perspective on that. Coming back to the macro, long time horizon. It's something we do have to embrace. We've got to figure out environmentally what the balance is there. But then from, you know, a training standpoint, critical thinking, job skills, we got to adapt.
Exactly. But then again, population growth is flattening out. By 2030, our mortality and fertility rates will be the same. Mm-hmm. We're not the only country. In fact, in most countries in the world, except in Africa, the replacement rate is over 2 for any couple having children. And in the U.S., it's 1.4. It's been there for a long time now, over 10 years. So we're not getting population growth. Our labor force is not growing. It's going to be like 0.1, 0.2% for the next 10 years. That's like adding 50,000 people to the U.S. labor force a year. I mean, come on. In one given month, you could hire that many people and more.
Yeah.
And so we really do need the automation. We are going to have a shortage of people to do things. And it gets a little worse as we push some of the, you know, immigrants out of the country. So we've got to remember that, the opportunity for other jobs is going to be there. You know, it just may not be in some places where you can easily replace a human. But for the work I do, I still write the code myself. I still handwrite out the model myself. So, but you made a point too that is a little scary about all this is, are we physically capable of supporting all of this evolution? The energy part you were mentioning, you know, you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're up against the wall, and I think, you know, somehow we've got to step back and take a look at the sort of the net of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Walter, always great being with you, man.
Yep.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.